It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR and at www.wrir.org. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
Anything your client says about, particularly a family member abuser, ask them if that's something that they do too, because often family members are family members because they have things in common. So... don't make the mistake of riding into court with all kinds of things against the abuser that then the abuser will turn and say, well, yeah, she does it too. It's bad. And, you know, ask your client, what's the worst thing he's going to say about you? Is he going to say you sleep around? Is not whether it's true or not, but what's he going to say? Does he say you sleep around? Does he say that you hit him too and here's the bruise? Does he say... you know, that you do way worse drugs than he does, or you drink constantly. You know, what are the things that he's going to say to the court about you? And then explore those hard.
Palma Pastilnik, staff attorney at Central Virginia Legal Aid Society's Charlottesville office, explains how to handle a petition for a protective order. And during this week's News You Can Use, you'll learn how we still tax too many low-wage workers into poverty and what we can do about it. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 301, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and online at www.wrir.org, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. A bipartisan initiative floating around Washington could drastically improve the financial well-being of 13 million hardworking Americans, including over 300,000 Virginians, strengthening the Federal Earned Income Tax Credit, or EITC, to help low-wage workers. The EITC is a proven tool that reduces poverty and lifts 6.5 million Americans out of poverty each year by providing much-needed tax relief to working families. But low-wage workers not raising children are the only group of workers in the U.S. that are still taxed into poverty. Around 7.5 million of these workers are taxed into, or deeper into, poverty each year, including 180,000 Virginia workers. The EITC has long provided a critical boost for millions of low-wage workers raising children, often helping them keep above the poverty line. However, this credit is still unavailable to millions of young low-wage workers under 25 who are just starting out on their careers, and many low-wage workers who are not raising children in their immediate household, including some who have children and make contributions to their well-being. The EITC was designed to allow low-wage workers to keep more of their hard-earned money to make ends meet. Yet, with the way the EITC is currently set up, too many working Americans fall through the cracks. Under the bipartisan plan, 304,000 low-wage Virginian workers would benefit from improvements to the EITC for those not raising children. Each year, 180,000 workers in Virginia are pushed into or deeper into poverty. The EITC often makes the difference for workers affording things like going back to school or putting in a down payment on a dependable vehicle to get to work, and it could be doing more. The most common occupations in Virginia of workers who would be helped by improvements to the EITC are cashiers, cooks, servers, retail workers, and custodians. These are community members who we interact with on a regular basis, many of whom are struggling to pay basic living expenses. The credit also pumps money back into the local communities where low-wage workers live. As Congress heads into session this upcoming year, they will have a unique opportunity to get behind a bipartisan initiative to help make the EITC work better for millions of hard-working, low-wage Americans. Everyone would like to see poverty reduced, and this improvement to the EITC is a common-sense initiative that both parties can get behind. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. Virginia's Domestic Violence Protective Order statutes cover both family abuse and non-family abuse. At this year's annual statewide legal aid conference, Palma Pistolnik, staff attorney at Central Virginia Legal Aid Society's Charlottesville office, explained how to handle a petition for a protective order. The Central Virginia Legal Aid radio show was there, and here is the first part of her continued remarks.
So, particularly when the most recent incident, viewed alone and in a vacuum, seems fairly minor. But when you view it as part of this progression or part of this history, this couple, it's a big deal. I have my client bring it to the court and we present there. So we're petitioning for this, and why this gave me fear, a reasonable apprehension, is because of this, 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 and this. And then you go chapter and verse all the way back, and if you need to bring in witnesses that either heard contemporaneous statements or saw the old bruises or heard the screaming or whatever, you bring those in. And always, if you're subpoenaing somebody, call them first and give them a heads up. You really need to ask your client every single question you can think of. And when your client is sitting in your office and you've only been doing this for a week or two, and they tell you that he had a gun, he waved it in front of the baby, he's got a terrible drug problem, we have to have him drug tested, we have to do all this stuff, don't do what I did and go into court and say he had a gun, it was in front of the baby, he needs to be drug tested. Because then the court will say, okay, go drug test both of them, and you didn't ask your client if she does drugs. And he does cocaine, and he's smart enough not to do it 3 days before court. And she smokes pot, and the last time she smoked it was a month ago. She didn't see that child for a year. Don't do that. Anything your client says about, particularly a family member abuser, ask them if that's something that they do too, because often family members are family members because they have things in common. So don't make the mistake of riding into court with all kinds of things against the abuser that then the abuser will turn and say, well, yeah, she does it too. It's bad. And, you know, ask your client, what's the worst thing he's going to say about you? Is he going to say, you sleep around? Is not whether it's true or not, but what's he going to say? Does he say you sleep around? Does he say that you hit him too and here's the bruise? Does he say, you know, that you do way worse drugs than he does, or you drink constantly? You know, what are the things that he's going to say to the court about you? And then explore those hard. Another piece of this is, if there's an accompanying criminal charge, most often, but not always, the respondent, who's also the defendant, will ask to leave the preliminary protective order in place until the criminal date so they don't risk incriminating themselves in the hearing about the facts of the incident that gave rise to both the petition and the criminal charge. So that sometimes will give you a lot more time to collect evidence, and you're collecting it in concert with the Commonwealth's attorney. Be friends with your Commonwealth's attorneys. they will be very, very, very helpful to you, and they'll put their case on first, and then you'll move to adopt that evidence, whether the guy's convicted or not, because remember, their burden is beyond a reasonable doubt. Your burden is only preponderance. So a guy who's acquitted on the criminal charge will still often, even usually, get the protective order granted against him unless the whole thing goes into the can. So remember that, and it's only on the respondent's petition because he is, in effect, volunteering to have his constitutional rights continue to be limited during this extra time that the state didn't think was appropriate to put in the power of the petitioner. However, the flip side of that is some defense attorneys like using that protective order hearing as a show me. And they want to go through your evidence. They want to get you on record. They bring a court reporter into the district court. And they want a look-see. And they don't particularly care if the protective order is granted because they're not going to let their client speak. They're not going to tell the judge that. But they're not. They're going to listen to your full case in chief. And then they'll either, you know, move that there not be a protective order or not even bother because they can always appeal it up to circuit court. So do be prepared. Just because there's a criminal charge doesn't mean that the respondent is going to move to continue it. If you've got, and you'll get to know, if you don't already know, the defense attorneys on the other side who will pull that on you. That happens a lot more often, I find, in either the student-on-student, where there's a significant criminal charge and there's a risk of some of these court things coming into the Title IX investigation and perhaps making it more likely than not that somebody might get expelled or at least be suspended. So either one of those would result in a permanent mark on their transcript that they'll have to deal with forever, which may be a lot more important to them than a protective order or an assault and battery conviction. So be aware that that problem can arise. It also, in J&D, is likely to occur when the respondent is the one who's got all the money and it's the divorce and equitable distribution could be very ugly for him. Those are the times when you're most likely to see a protective order contested on the original set date, even when there's a criminal charge accompanying. Sometimes once she's filed her petition, then he'll go and file one, or if she's filed a warrant, then he'll go and file one. And then that's, again, knowing your Commonwealth's attorney and knowing your police officers who were involved in the altercation and were the ones who assessed who the primary aggressor was, or perhaps later on when they saw the bruises come out on her throat after they initially thought because she scratched his wrist that she was the primary aggressor because they could see the bloody scratches on his wrist when they responded. But after they booked her, they see that, you know, she's got these black marks all over her throat. They're like, oh, wait, she wasn't the primary aggressor, he was, and they rethink that. But you can wind up with cross petitions, and you need to be able to unsnarl whether or not the police got it right, whether they got it right initially or later, what your Commonwealth's attorney is going to do, whether or not they understand the notion of a spite warrant and will dismiss it if it's filed, you know, oh, he filed that warrant 15 minutes after he was served with the preliminary protective order. I think that's a spite warrant. Let's get rid of that. You can have that discussion with your Commonwealth's attorney. And if the evidence supports that, you can often get that level of cooperation. But to your question, yeah, sometimes it's a free-for-all, and both of them are legitimately entitled to, under the, you know, the things you have to check off under the statute, each of them would be equally entitled to a protective order. And while that's not grounds for not granting one, a lot of times a judge will say, I don't want any part of this. Y'all need to behave. It's not necessarily this thing that's most likely to safeguard that family, but that can happen. This is hugely important because the protective order, remember, only controls the movements and actions of the respondent. There is nothing in a no contact, no exceptions order that affects your client's ability to contact anybody. However, if she's poking at him or reaching out to him or texting him in the middle of the night, he can come into court with all of that evidence on a motion to dismiss and say, she's not really afraid of me. She wants me back. Dismiss the protective order. So, yeah, the talk after court is just as important as the talk before court. Go into one of those conference rooms right off the courtroom, sit down with your client and say, okay, so do not contact him. If there's property that needs to be divided, I'll give him my card or I'll give his lawyer my card. We'll figure that out. Enforce your protective order. Here's what contact can look like. If he does these things, call 911 and then call me. If he does these things, call me. If he does these things, do this. Because a protective order that isn't enforced is no good. And while some people, some respondents will take that protective order and go, and follow it, that's not the most usual response. Usually it's, huh, all right. She doesn't want me to control her like that anymore. Let's see how else I can control her. And then they'll just poke around the edges and see what they can get away with. So you need to help your client learn how to look for it and how to deal with it. And also what safety planning looks like based on what the relationship has been, whether there have been guns, whether he's threatened her with those guns, whether he's already shown a willingness to break into her home, whether he's shown a willingness to show up at school and mess with the kids. These are all things that you need to be aware of, and you need to be discussing with your client and the people around them how to deal with it. For families that have children, at any time in this process, but particularly with the preliminary protective order, the emergency protective order, get certified copies so that any person that those children are with that's not the parent has a copy of that protective order so that they know not to give the child to the other parent, and law enforcement has a clear piece of paper in hand that shows that that is not a superior claim. Because if the child is being left with grandma and dad comes to get the child, absent that protective order, the police are going to take the child from grandma and give it to dad. And so we don't want that happening.
You've been listening to Palma Pistolnik, staff attorney at Central Virginia Legal Aid Society's Charlottesville office, explaining how to handle a petition for a protective order. We'll be back in a moment. We continue now with the concluding remarks of Palma Pistolnik, staff attorney at Central Virginia Legal Aid Society's Charlottesville office, explaining how to handle a petition for a protective order.
So, generally speaking, when there's a criminal charge arising out of the same event, so he hits her over the head with a frying pan, he's charged with domestic assault and battery, and she files a petition for a protective order. Generally speaking, at that point, his defense counsel in the criminal proceeding will recommend that he not testify about that frying pan at the protective order hearing that's set within 14 days, and that he asked the court to extend the preliminary protective order to the date of his criminal hearing. Most courts hear them together, although I understand there are some jurisdictions that don't get that changed if yours is one of them. And so what will happen is the Commonwealth will get up, and they will put on all the evidence about the frying pan, the head, the injury, and either he will be convicted of domestic assault and battery or not. Then you stand up for the protective order hearing. The first thing you do is ask to move all the evidence from the criminal proceeding into the protective order proceeding. So everything about the frying pan incident has already now been heard. You don't have to do it all over again. Same judge standing right there. It's one. I'm standing right next to the Commonwealth's attorney while she's giving her criminal hearing, and then I step forward and do my protective order immediately. I mean, we're all right there. Nobody's moved. That evidence comes in. Then if I have other evidence for other protections and relief needed that wouldn't have come out in the criminal hearing, I present then that evidence. So whether the children were in the house, whether they saw daddy hit mom with the frying pan, or he ripped the kid out of mommy's arms and threw him across the room before he hit her in the head with the frying pan. Again, not an element of the crime, but certainly something important about how to deal with all of the other pieces of the family in the protective order. That evidence then comes in. and he can contest that evidence if he wants, and then the protective order is granted. This is, again, part of why it's so important to have those relationships. This practice is so much easier and so much more thorough, and you are able to accomplish so much more for your client when you have really, really solid relationships with your judges, your Commonwealth's attorneys, your clerks, your victim witness advocates, your shelter people, your hospital people, the SANE nurse, the people doing the Title IX work at the local university or college. You need your police, all the departments, the city, the county, the university. You need to have really, really solid relationships with these people. And if you don't have some kind of either a SART or that's a sexual assault response team, or a domestic violence counsel, make one. Get those people sitting around a table once a month. You have lunch together, you talk together, you see where the bottlenecks are occurring, where the problems are occurring. If a clerk suddenly decides that she needs to be practicing law and she's whispering in the judge's ear about why he shouldn't grant a protective order, despite what you're saying, you know, you need to see these problems coming up ahead of time, and you need to have these relationships. Something else that you do need to go through with your client, if the children are definitely at risk from the behavior of the respondent, one of the conversations you have to have with your client is, okay, if you're not being a protective parent, social services can come in and either decide that for whatever reason, because you're living a marginal existence because you don't have any money or any means of support, or you have poor housing or whatever, that the children are better off with him, or if they do understand that he's a bad guy, they may just take them into care. And so you need to make sure that you are not just protecting yourself, but you're protecting your children. So you do need to have that conversation with your client about being the protective parent. What I will usually recommend to my clients, if they truly believe and the evidence supports that the sole reason or the sole driving force behind the violence in the relationship is substance abuse, is I recommend that whatever else they have, whether it's conditions of probation or good behavior, whatever, that mandates a substance abuse assessment and follow the recommendations and blah, 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 that they get that in the protective order too, and they keep some kind of protective order. Either initially keep the no contact, no exceptions, and see if he actually goes to the program and starts following the program, and then they can always amend it to a no violent or abusive contact or some other interim, more controlled, but not no contact, no exceptions, because it's a lot easier to amend and reduce the protections in a protective order than to get a new one if there isn't another significant event. And that can be a challenging conversation to have with your client, because you're like, well, I want my family back. And that's sometimes where you have to go through with them again. Well, what is it that you are calling your family? Because here's what you told me your family was. And I don't think that's what you want back. I think you want back this idea of what your family should be. And here's the better path, the safer path for us to get there. So conviction for violation of protective order the first time is mandatory jail, and that can be as little as one day. And then the penalties are more stringent depending on what kinds of, and these are only for the contact violations, not the show cause violations. So violation of protective order that is a crime involves violation of the contact provisions. If you have other relief provisions in there, like paying the utilities or paying spousal support or paying child support or whatever, those are just like any regular court order, they're enforced with a motion to show cause. So those are not criminal violations. But criminal violations are violations of the contact provisions. And if one of multiple violations involves force or threat or bodily injury, the third one, no matter what they did that violated the contact provisions, can be charged as a felony. So, and those are all set forth in the statute and with specificity. But yeah, even the first violation is mandatory jail time. So it's a real deal. And if any of them involved any kind of violence, then you get to a felony pretty quickly.
You've been listening to Palma Pastelnik, staff attorney at Central Virginia Legal Aid Society's Charlottesville office, explaining how to handle a petition for a protective order. This is the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio show ever broadcast is available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is a key part of the fight to protect consumers from abusive financial practices. Join us next Wednesday at 12:30 p.m. when Senator Elizabeth Warren explains why citizens must defend consumer financial protection and keep up the fight to reform the financial system. That's law for the rest of us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright. Oh.